Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Hey, merry meet everybody, and welcome once again to Stirring the Cauldron here on the Para-X Radio Network. Tonight's opening song was called Lick the Maypole. Now, odd title, nice music, and I chose a maypole song because Beltane, also known as May Day, is just around the corner on May 1st. So get ready to dance around a maypole, and if you can't find one, perhaps you can find a bonfire to dance around instead. Or you could make a wish at a hawthorn tree. Or commune with the fairies, because this is their favorite time of year. Beltane is the night when the Queen of Fairies rides out on her white steed to entice humans away to fairyland. And if you listen to the bells of the Queen's horse, you're advised to look away, and then she'll pass you by. But if you look at the Queen, and you shouldn't, you're not going to be able to get away. So whatever you do, besides not looking at the Queen, don't step in a fairy ring, because, as the warnings go, the fairies are going to snatch you up to dance, they're going to entice you and enthrall you, but they'll also keep you. And a night's worth of dancing can mean your life. So should you escape the fairy ring, and a few have, I suppose, all your long years will come crashing down on you, and death will be really pretty close behind. Now, that being said, I didn't mention the Green Man, who is also associated with Beltane, but that was kind of on purpose, because on May 12th, Dave the Bard will be joining me to talk about the Green Man and a couple of other interesting things coming up. So, in the meantime, everybody on May Day, have a blessed Beltane, and now let's get down to business. My guest tonight is author Thomas J. Carey. Now, Tom is a U.S. Air Force veteran who held a top-secret security clearance, and he spent the last 23 years investigating the Roswell incident and has published more than 35 articles about it. He's appeared on numerous radio and TV shows, and he's contributed to a number of Roswell-related documents. Now, those of you who are regular listeners to the show have heard him before talking about his books, Witness to Roswell, and Inside the Real Area 51, co-authored by Donald Schmidt. And tonight he's back to talk about their book, The Children of Roswell, a seven-decade legacy of fear, intimidation, and cover-ups. If you have any questions for Tom or comments as we go along, as always, please send them to me in private chat. And if you're in the Para-X chat room, if you're not in the Para-X chat room, come and join us at www.para-x.com. Tom, welcome back.
Nice to be with you, Marla. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. I was kind of like, ooh, that book was kind of interesting. because, okay, first of all, I really like that in the press kit there came a quote that said, this is not your grandma's Roswell book. And it isn't another book about the Roswell incident itself. It's about the aftermath and the impact that Roswell has had on the witnesses and their families who knew the truth but had to keep or had to accept the government's account of the incident and keep shut because they were afraid of what would happen to them if they spoke up. And that's kind of scary stuff.
Yes, it's this is our third book on the Roswell trilogy that we've done. We did it about the families and the children and the grandchildren, basically for two reasons. One, that's all that's left as far as the witnesses are concerned. All of the primary first-hand witnesses who were there at the time in 1947 when this spaceship from another world crashed just north of Roswell, most of those witnesses are gone now. To put it in perspective, Marla, if you were 20 years old in 1947 when this happened, next year you would be 90 years old. You're still alive. So,
right.
So most of them are gone. And over the years, we have talked to children and more recently, grandchildren. But we focused most of our attention went on the primary witnesses. Well, now our focus out of convenience, because that's basically all that's left, we focused on the children and the grandchildren and how the incident affected their families, especially the families of the primary witnesses. Were they threatened? How were they threatened? Did it keep them from talking, which it certainly did? And just how did that all shake out? And that's what our the focus of our book is, the children of Roswell.
Yeah. Now, you know, like you said, there are no probably primary witnesses that we know of that are probably still around. But the government is going to really great lengths to keep their families quiet. I mean, and after all these years, I mean, we're talking what, 70 years. And you say in the book that there are two possible reasons for this. Either something really did fall out of the sky, as witnesses have attested to, or there's a major cover-up of some sort of maybe secret project that went awry. Which of the two theories are you leaning towards more?
Well, the Air Force actually helped us on that. The Air Force... in 1993, 94, 95, they themselves conducted they called it a reopening of the Roswell case, because there was a congressman at that time named Stephen Schiff from New Mexico who tasked the Government Accounting Office, which is the investigative arm of Congress, because he was trying to find out about what happened to the documents relating to Roswell, and he was getting the runaround from the Defense Department. So he put the GAO on the case, and the Air Force, they said, well, we're going to do our own investigation, too. So the Air Force, we already came to the conclusion that it was not a V-2 rocket, it was not an atomic bomb inadvertently got loose. The Air Force's position was that it came down to a balloon, a weather-tight balloon that was strung together in a row to lift an acoustic sensor up into the ionosphere to listen in to the expected detonation of the Soviet Union's first atomic bomb. So that's what they said it was. It was a string of rubber weather balloons and tinfoil radar targets that hoisted a microphone, so to speak, up into the ionosphere. And they said all other possibilities failed. That would be a V-2 rocket, an errant atomic bomb, and most likely if they had used it, if they had said, well, it was a crash of one of our latest fighter jets with a, it was built with a new alloy, and that would have stuck, I think. They would have been on better ground had they said it was a, you know, the latest fighter plane that they were testing, even though it would have been a lie. But that would have stuck, and we wouldn't be here tonight talking about it. But they went so far afield with this. First, they called it a weather balloon in 47. Then in 94, 95, when they reopened the case, they called it this high-altitude Project Mogul balloon, which was really the same type of balloon as the weather balloon. So they kept sticking their foot in it, you know, and nobody believes them today. And they said the little bodies that were talked about were these... what was reported were these little 3.5 to 4 feet tall, little frail bodies with these large, oversized, egg-shaped heads. And they said, well, what those were these anthropomorphic dummies that you see in the clothing store windows, you know, that they look human, they're like 6 foot tall. And in this case, they said they were used in these high-altitude parachute drops that began in the mid-1950s, 10 years after the Roswell incident. So that's how they explain away the bodies. So they stuck their foot in it again. And so every other explanation other than that it was a craft from another world, probably another solar system and another star system, everything else other than that fails based on the witness testimony of what they saw and experienced. Everything fails other than the spaceship from another world with a number of occupants. I think in science, they call it... oh, my goodness, I lost the term. When you have competing theories, and they use the one that requires the least numbers of turns to get from A to Z, the one that requires the least number of turns off the straight line. And in this case, that would be the extraterrestrial explanation would be the simplest answer. And there's a term for that. It's named after a middle-aged bishop, and the name of it escapes me, Occam's Razor, that's it. Occam's Razor, the law of parsimony, which means the most conservative explanation that requires the fewest detours to explain the known data is the one you have to go with when you have competing theories. And when you apply Occam's Razor to the Roswell incident, you get extraterrestrial spaceship.
That makes sense. Well, but either way, okay, let's look at it this way. One could get the impression that whatever happened back then was so terrific that the knowledge of the truth would be unbearable for us to endure. Seriously, I mean, honestly, how bad can it be?
Right. What you may not know is that at the time of the Roswell incident, which was the crash, we have zeroed it down to it occurred late in the evening of July the 2nd, 1947. Well, at that time, there was a weather balloon, because the Air Force or the Air Corps, it was called back then, they launched these weather balloons all the time, you know, to test the winds aloft. And one of them came down before the Roswell incident in Circleville, Ohio. One came down. It made the newspapers. A local farmer's daughter, actually, found it. They had a picture of her in the newspaper. And three others came down right immediately after the crash at Roswell. They all made the newspaper, but none of them none of them resulted in a Roswell-type event where you had all the military out in the field scouring the desert floor, picking up little pieces of wreckage, people being threatened with their lives, the whole ball of wax that took place at Roswell. None of that took place with these other three incidents that occurred right at the same time as the Roswell incident. So how come we didn't get the, you know, all of the threats and the application of all these military people cordoning off highways and, you know, you can't go this way and you can't go that way. And you know what I mean? There was Roswell, a Roswell-type event only occurred once, and that was in Roswell, New Mexico. Even though similar claim, I mean, what they claimed crashed at Roswell, this weather balloon, actually three others had come down in other parts of the country. One in Circleville, Ohio, one near Bakersfield, California, and one in upstate New York, all at the same time, but none of them resulted in any activity like you got down in Roswell.
Mm-hmm. You know, curiosity is one of the greatest and sometimes the worst traits of human nature, followed by greed, right? And
yes.
So it's common knowledge that right after the crash,
there's a couple bad traits. humans, a couple of bad traits. But greed and sloth.
But
lying is
yes.
another.
There you go.
Go ahead.
No, it's okay. We could just tick these off on their list, right? But it's common knowledge that right after the crash, tons of curious people flocked to the site. They looted the site before officials got there. And there can be no possible way for the government to know how many people took things and ran, or who they were, for that matter. Have you ever wondered what they might have taken, where the loot might be, and how they knew to keep shut about their treasure since they were anonymous and the government couldn't have come down on them?
We know that in this remote part of New Mexico, there were a number of aircraft crashes because you had Kirtland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, you had the Roswell Army Airfield in Roswell, you had an Air Force Base in Alamogordo, several Army bases. So there were occasional crashes that occurred in the remote desert there, and it was always the civilians who would get to the crash sites first before the military, always. And what they were doing is that, you know, they wanted to, because even though telephones were rare out there in the ranch, you know, in the ranch land, telephones were rare, TV was non-existent, electricity was very sparse, but word of mouth traveled fast. Everybody could ride a horse, sort of like Paul Revere. You know, there's been a crash, you know, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So word of mouth traveled fast, and the civilians got out there first. And it was no different for the crash of a spaceship from another world. And sure enough, the civilians got out there first to see what was, you know, if anybody was hurt and if they could help and to see what was going on. And also, they always took souvenirs. Mm-hmm. They pocketed souvenirs from the crash. And it was no different with regard to the Roswell crash. The problem is that the Air Force really put down the hammer not only on Roswell civilians, but also the outlying ranchers, who they strongly suspected correctly had stashed away pieces of wreckage. Mm-hmm. And they made a sweep. They tore up floorboards. They cut open cattle feed, sacks of feed. They drained water tanks looking for pieces of wreckage. Well, the ranchers are, and they did collect a lot. And we do have stories from firsthand witnesses of their activities. Of when the military came out, they were not nice. They just said, "We're going to look around," and boy, they really tore up, you know, the various ranches. And this was all illegal, of course, because the military can only do this in areas that they have jurisdiction, military reservations, in time of war, and in time of martial law. None of that existed in what they were doing around the ranchers in Roswell and in Roswell. But nevertheless, they went ahead and did it. They were civil rights violations. They would not dare do it today without some declaration of martial law or, you know, something else. So, yeah. But we've heard stories, and I interviewed all the ranchers that I could interview, and they were, this would be like 10 years ago, mm-hmm. and they were very tight-lipped still. And we, Don and I, we both know that there are pieces of wreckage out there. We've had three different witnesses who don't know one another, but they knew this one family member, and I won't say his name, but you would recognize it. They all three of them, one lives in California, one lives in Alabama, another lives in the Midwest. They all said the same story, and they don't know each other, about this one family member who they insisted still has a piece of the wreckage being stored at their residence. And we know this person very well, and he denies it to our face. Mm-hmm. And we don't believe him, because why would these other three who don't know one another tell us the same story, that mm-hmm. he showed them a piece of flying saucer, as they called it, wreckage? So yeah. we know there are pieces out there. But the ranchers are very, very circumspect still. One thing is they resent it being called the Roswell incident, because the crash actually occurred, the explosion where the craft blew up and most of the wreckage was found, was in Lincoln County, near the town of Corona, then near Roswell. And so they still resent that, but they don't trust anybody, to be honest with you. They just don't trust anybody. But we know there's pieces out there. There's also pieces that have been suggested that they're in, you know, a piece in this person's house and that person's house in Roswell. Most notably, the Jesse Marcel, the base public information officer. We have a story that he had a piece at home, and that he stuck it underneath a patio in back had just been poured. Mm-hmm. And even though the patio's flat and the sides are square, but where it meets the ground, there's always like spaces underneath. You know,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the thought is that he stuck it in one of those spaces underneath the patio, and unfortunately that patio is now inside the house as the floor of the family room, so or a bedroom. So we can't very well go in and break up somebody's house, but that story is still out there. There's another one that the base public information officer, Walter Hout, who lived just a few houses away from Jesse Marcel, that he stuck a piece in his crawl space underneath the house. Mm-hmm. Well, we can't get under there. We actually at one point offered to buy the Marcel house, but we were just a little bit too late. And we also offered to break up the floor looking for this, and put down another floor to the current house owner that was even better than the one that's in there, but they didn't like that either, so we're sort of stuck on those.
You tried.
but we tried. But we know yeah. there are pieces out there, but the Air Force, I mean, they were down on their hands and knees out there on the desert floor mm-hmm. with orders to pick up anything that wasn't natural. You know? Anything that wasn't natural to the area, pick it up and put it in a burlap bag, where they collected them all at a general central collecting site. So they went through their paces, but the other thing we know is that due to the wind currents out there and how light this wreckage was that some of the pieces had to have been blown miles away from the crash site by the wind. They have a lot of these dust devils. I mean, we've seen some of those dust devils when we were out there ourselves, and they will take things miles away. And there's no doubt that if you follow the trajectory of the craft that exploded, and the inner cabin of it remained aloft for another 35 miles, if you follow that direct trajectory, there has to be pieces of the wreckage along that flight line that came off. But it's such a long, you know, we're talking about 35 miles in the desert, and looking for a needle in the haystack, what are your chances? It's going to be somebody hiking or somebody out there fortuitously finding a piece, but it's very, very remote, and so far it hasn't happened.
Yeah. Now, you said in the book that anyone at the base who had contact with the crash retrieval was threatened with prison if they talked about it, and civilians received death threats.
Yes.
And that goes against all that we used to be taught about how the government had our best interests at heart. They were there to keep us safe. We should trust them above all else. And then we read that they were threatening and bullying. And that must have been very eye-opening, no?
Yes. This you have to understand, this was 1947. The military was full of itself at that time. They had just won World War II, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's 2 years after World War II ended. They were never held in such high esteem since that time. It started on the downward trend with Korea. All of these unwinnable, you know, all of these wars where we didn't win, you know, they were sort of like our truces. There was no clear winner. And Vietnam, where we lost. And so in 1947, we had just defeated Germany, Japan, and Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So they were full of themselves. And the military people who were involved in the recovery, the way they handled those people was that they, on the Roswell Air Base, just about 7 miles south of the center city, Roswell, they would gather each squadron in a hangar. They'd get them all together, and there were three flight squadrons, they flew B-29s. There were three units, three squadrons, and they would gather them in individually in a hangar, and in would come the master sergeant, who was the first sergeant, and he would read the riot act, and then would come the commanding officer of the squadron, and the message went something like this: okay, fellas, you think you've heard something that's been going around the base, let me tell you, you better keep quiet about it, because if you want to talk about it or read about it or learn more about it, you can read about it in Leavenworth. And that's Leavenworth Federal Prison in, I think it's Kansas.
Yeah.
And so the threat was clear. So the military, you're talking about listees, they sort of kept quiet for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the officers were treated a little more humanely, but the because, you know, they're officers and a gentleman, right? So they were treated more humanely, but the message was pretty much the same: keep quiet or else. Now, the civilians, as I said, there was no direct authority between the military and the civilian population, whether in Roswell or around the surrounding ranches. So what they did is they enlisted the help of the sheriff, Sheriff George Wilcox. He was Sheriff of Chavez County, the headquarters of which was in Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And he was fluent in Spanish, and so they used him especially against the Hispanic population, who knew about the crash, because word. We had it from a source, a woman who owned a store in Roswell, that word of the crash got around the entire town of Roswell in 20 minutes. Once somebody came back to town having been there, word got around town in 20 minutes, really fast. Mm-hmm. So they used the sheriff to, especially against the Hispanics, to tell them that they better keep quiet, or else not only would the parents be killed, the adults, but their entire families would be killed if they spoke. That's how deep the threat was. They mm-hmm. even brought in Senator Dennis Chavez from Washington, D.C., to reinforce that threat to the local Spanish population in Roswell. A sitting U.S. senator, they flew back to Roswell to administer, to follow up on the threat that Sheriff Wilcox delivered. Now, the sheriff apparently, at some point, they asked him to deliver a threat on somebody he knew, and he refused. This would be one of the firemen. His name was Dan Dwyer. He had gotten out to the site, the crash site, before the military, and had seen the crash and had seen the bodies. And I'm speculating that they said, okay, go meet with Dwyer and give him the threat. And I'm guessing that Wilcox just refused, because they sent out a lieutenant who was the town liaison. He was whenever there was an event in town, they used this one lieutenant to coordinate with the local Roswell police and the sheriff's department to scope out what would be needed to hold this military event in town. Usually a march down Main Street, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I know, and sometimes they would have military vehicles like tanks and things go down Main Street. So they sent him in. His name was Arthur Philbin. He was a lieutenant. And he delivered a death threat to a 12-year-old child named Frankie Dwyer Rowe. She was Dan Dwyer's daughter. She not only knew about the crash from her father, but she had handled a piece of the wreckage at the firehouse. She had been in town for some dental work and went to the firehouse afterwards to wait for her father to take her home. While she was there, a highway patrolman had come in. He had been up north, and he had either gotten to the crash site or somebody gave him a piece of the memory metal. This would be a piece of the wreckage that had this exotic nature to it, where you could crunch it up in your hand and open your hand, and it would just sort of float there in the air and float down to the table without a crease, without a crease, and you couldn't cut it, scratch it, or do anything to it. So she had handled a piece of that in the firehouse. So the next day, her father's at work, and she's at home with her mother, and there's a knock on the door. And it's this officer. He's from Brooklyn, New York. He had a Brooklyn accent, and he was like 6'4", with wide shoulders, and really, really menacing looking. And he had one of these nightsticks in his hand, that like a club.
Right.
And two other officers took the mother, Frankie's mother, into the kitchen and closed the door. And this officer, Arthur Philbin, took Frankie into the living room. And he tried to convince her that she didn't hear what she heard from her father, and that she didn't handle what she thought she had handled. And she says, no, that's wrong. So he started pounding this nightstick in his hand. And so he administered the threat to Frankie that if she loved her parents, she would not ever talk about this again, because if she did, not only would she be killed, but her parents would be killed. The whole family would be taken out into the desert, and their bones would not be found, because it was a big desert out there. How's that for talking to a 12-year-old?
Yeah, really. All right, so with all these threats going on, Now, you and Donald Schmidt have interviewed literally hundreds of people over the years.
625.
There you go. Have you ever found out that there was any repercussion to any of the people that you spoke to? And have the two of you been threatened for writing these books and digging hard to present the truths that you're finding out?
Well, I'll answer the second question first. No, not that I'm aware of. No one's threatened me.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had no strangers meet me on the street or anything like that. The only thing that I've heard is like clicking on the telephone, and Don Schmidt has heard the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And to my knowledge, Don has not been threatened. And we believe it's because the case is actually out in the open now.
Mm-hmm.
After almost 70 years, it's the most thoroughly investigated UFO case of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And the researchers are known. Don and I are known pretty much around the world as researchers of the Roswell case. So the best defense is putting sunlight. Is putting sunlight on something. And there's sunlight on the case, there's sunlight on me, there's sunlight on Don Schmidt, there's sunlight on other Roswell researchers. And that's the best defense. And the same with the witnesses. A lot of the witnesses are known. Jesse Marcel is gone. Jesse Marcel Jr., the son of intelligence officer at Roswell, is now gone. And his grandson, Jesse Sr.'s grandson, Jesse Jr., not Jesse, Jesse the Third, has picked up the torch. So all these are known people. And with so much out there, especially on cable TV,
mm-hmm.
there's all sorts of UFO shows and Roswell, what have you. It's widely known. I think it's widely accepted that there's other life in the universe that has it's not only out there but has visited us and is still visiting us. So, no, I've not been threatened, and to my knowledge, Don hasn't been threatened. Now, as far as the families, it's been sort of every reaction you can imagine. One witness that I talked to before he passed away was a former National Football League player. It's interesting, we have the National Football League draft going on as we speak, but he was a Hall of Fame player for the Philadelphia Eagles. His name was Tom Brookshire. He was aware of the medal. He was a first-hand witness to this memory medal that just floated in the air. He
mm-hmm.
also was a witness to the base going into lockdown. It was like you've heard of the Iron Curtain, Winston Churchill's famous speech in 1946 that there's been an Iron Curtain that has descended upon Eastern Europe courtesy of the Soviet Union. Well, when this Roswell incident happened, according to Tom Brookshire, he said it was like an Iron Curtain had descended around the base, the Roswell Army Airfield, south of town. He knew a lot of people from the base because his father owned a service station on Main Street, and most of the airmen who owned vehicles would use his father's gas station, and Tom would, he was 16 years old in 1947, by the way, he
mm-hmm.
pumped gas there, so he got to know a lot of them, and he said, when the curtain was finally lifted, he said, all of his people that he knew from the base wouldn't talk to him anymore. It was like they were told not to interact as little as possible with the townsfolk of Roswell. The town was never the same after that in relationship to the base that was so close to it. So that was another thing. But Tom himself, as I said, he was 16 years old at the time. Some people are naturally gregarious and they see humor in everything.
Mm-hmm.
Tom was Tom was one of those. And the Roswell incident did not affect him at all that I could see. When I spoke to him, he was still this gregarious, humorous fellow. I had never talked to him before, and we talked like we had known one another for many years. He was that nice of a guy.
Uh-huh.
And he passed away shortly after I interviewed him in 2008 or 2009. He passed away in 2010 from gallbladder cancer. It was from diagnosis to termination was like 6 months. He just, and nobody knew he was sick. Mm. But he was one extreme of the behavior. It did not affect him at all could detect. Mm. Others, like the Wilcox family, the sheriff, mm-hmm. according to his family, now he died in 1961. He never ran for sheriff again. And according to his family, and we get this first from his children, he had two daughters. We got it from them, and then we got it from his grandchildren, a woman named Barbara Duggar, and his other grandchild, a male named George. George
mm-hmm.
Was grandson, and they said that the Roswell incident destroyed him. It destroyed him. And geez, what do you mean by that? I mean, it's, you know, he was doing his job. He maybe didn't like delivering the death threats, but I can understand that. But I mean, would that destroy you? I don't know. But what really destroyed him was, now here you have the sheriff of Chavez County, mm-hmm. that included Roswell. He helps the base out by delivering these warnings around the citizens. And one day, the military pulls up in front of the sheriff's office. Now, there were enough trucks, they circled the office. And in comes this Arthur Philbin. And he puts the sheriff in a hammer lock, shoves him up against the wall. And the sheriff's family, they lived above the sheriff's office. That was part of the deal for being a sheriff, is that you got an apartment above the sheriff's office, and they lived, and they could see all that was going on. And his wife Inez comes down, and her husband is in a hammer lock, and this is the sheriff, and mm-hmm. he's shoved face up against the wall, and they're saying, Now they thought they were coming to tell him what a great job they did, but instead here they're treating them like criminals. And the message was, if you ever talk about this, we're going to kill you and kill your children, including your grandchildren. Now how's that to deliver to the sheriff of Chavez County? Well, the family, of course, they remained silent for years until the moon landing in 1969. The sheriff was gone, but his wife was still alive, and she told the granddaughter and the grandson what had happened back in 1947. And the grandson told me that he spent some time with the sheriff when he was in school. He would stop over the residents, mm-hmm. and this is after the sheriff was not sheriff anymore. He said every time a car went by, the sheriff, former sheriff, would jump up, run to the window, really scared, look out the window like he was afraid somebody was following him or somebody was after him. He said he was clearly paranoid, and a short time later, this would be now in 1961, he attacked his own wife, Inez, and they put him in a mental hospital, and he died shortly thereafter. And his wife, Inez, to the day she died in 1978, she believed that the Air Force had done something to him, because they called him out to the base. After that, they called him out to the base, and when he came back, She said he had this faraway look in his eye, and he looked like he had been roughed up again. Mm-hmm. And she believed that they gave him something, like a shot or something, that created an early onset of Alzheimer's. And he died of Alzheimer's in 1961, but she believed that they had done something to him. So that's mm-hmm. the other extreme. So, those are the two extremes that I gave you. One who was not affected at all, and others where it really destroyed a family.
Yeah, I mean, scare tactics and whatever they thought would work, they were doing. I mean, people have gone missing over time.
Suicides. We had a couple suicides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, do you think, though, that the level of fear of the descendants of the crash witnesses diminishes with each new generation, or do you think the scare tactics are still being utilized?
In some cases, like the outlying ranchers, the scare tactics have still caused them not to really tell us anything. Because I know when I did I called all the ranchers that were still alive 10 years ago. This would be around 2005, 2006. Most of those, I don't remember anything, or no, I don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm saying, oh my goodness, we know, the reason I'm calling you is someone said that you did, and they would just stonewall me. So, mm-hmm. yes, in those cases, the it's still working. But like I said, we have had 625 or thereabouts that have told us what they knew. So mm-hmm. it's sort of a mixed bag. We're glad that we've got like 625. Now, they're not all firsthand witnesses. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are second and third hand. But when you put them all together, they form a picture. And but they're still, especially. Oh, the other thing is that the officers that we interview are the least likely to talk. It was the enlisted men, especially enlisted men who didn't make the Air Force or the military career.
Yeah,
the ones who did were less likely to talk because they're now retired or were retired on a government military pension. So they didn't want to mm-hmm. say anything to upset their pensions. No matter how you pleaded with them, it can happen, it never has happened, but they didn't want to upset the apple cart. So those people who were government retirees, whether military or some other form of the government, were less likely to talk than those who were not retired military or retired government. And among those, the higher the rank officer, the less likely they were to talk. We got mm-hmm. a few, very few, to talk, but they were not career military. So
right.
that's the way it broke out.
Well, and the interesting thing too is in a way this thing will never die, in the sense that maybe now it might, but in the beginning, you know, people wouldn't talk. Okay. Then 20, 30, 40, even 50 years later, there came a lot of deathbed confessions because they had nothing to lose. They didn't think that telling anybody at that point would be harmful. But that's,
correct.
I think, where some of the children and the grandchildren and you know, they come in, and then that's something new to them because they might not have even known about Roswell. And then
right.
they hear it, then they start looking it up, and then it's, you know, it's a whole new thing. So, I mean, this is like something that never dies.
Right. They learned that Granddad was at Roswell, and hey, Granddad, you were at Roswell. Well, yes. Well, tell us what happened. And sometimes they tell them, and sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had plenty of that. We had one case where the chaplain. This was the chaplain at Roswell at the time. He was career military, and they went. He was at a number of bases in his career, both he and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And their children, he told their children about all the bases he was at except Roswell. And they didn't find that out until after he was dead. And then they went through his papers, and because on his deathbed he was mumbling. Now, this is the chaplain. Mm-hmm. And he was mumbling on his deathbed about there were many mansions in my father's house, something like that's one of the general statements. I may have it wrong, but there are many houses in my father's mansion, or many mansions in my father's house was one. And he was saying things, I'm just a man, I'm just a man, things that they could not understand. What is he talking about? Mm-hmm. Well, after he passed away, the mother, who was still alive, said, well, he was at Roswell, and during the event, he was relieved of duty, and they brought in a priest, and we speculated that he either himself lost it, he either lost it and had to be relieved, or they brought in a priest who could take confessions without having to repeat to anybody what was confessed. Mm-hmm. So that's a little known fact, but it's true.
Do you think there's still a watch list?
We learned from a witness on his deathbed. We asked him, because we believe he was an insider. We believe he was sent to Roswell. He was at Roswell at the time. He was from Brooklyn himself, but he was planning to go back to Brooklyn. But we believe he was ordered to stay at Roswell. He became a member of the Chamber of Commerce there. And we believe he was also a disinformation specialist. But we talked to him on his deathbed, and we said, okay, what's the game plan? What's the game plan now? He says, to run out the clock. It's like a football game, you know, mm-hmm. where one team's winning and they're just running out the clock. He said the plan now is just to run out the clock till everybody passes away. And they're pretty much, that's where they're pretty much at right now.
Well, they're going to, you know, like you said, everybody's pretty much passed away, but there's still always going to be. And at some point, you know, somebody's going to run into the Antiques Roadshow with a piece of metal that floats in the right. air and doesn't have a crease. And then, you know, the whole ball of wax is going to start up again. So, I mean.
Yes. Yes. There's always somebody. In fact, we, on the positive note, we did find three new firsthand witnesses, former military from 1947, who were still alive within, we're now in April. This year, we found three new firsthand witnesses still alive. And they were guards at the hangar where all this stuff was stored. And they were given, as they called them, grease guns. These are little carbines, semi-automatic carbines, and with orders, shoot to kill if anybody tries to cross the, get into the hangar. Shoot first, ask questions later, all over a weather balloon.
Yeah, imagine that. All that fuss over a weather balloon. It really is kind of amazing because, you know, I think people that are interested in the topic should actually go and get both the previous books. Because there's just so much in there, you know, inside stuff, and
it's our belief, because all three of our books, people just raised, they all made number one in their category on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
They made number one in several categories, and number two in several other categories. All three mm-hmm. of them, and Witness to Roswell, our first book, was the top-selling UFO book in the world for 3 years.
Wow!
The Area 51 book, it's called Inside the Real Area 51: The Secret History of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That made number one in and we're really proud of this, in the astronomy and space sciences category, plus plus the usual category that UFO books are categorized at. But it also made number one in astronomy and space science, so we're proud of that. The current book, which came out just a few weeks ago, made number one in several categories, and so it's still fresh out there, and we're what we think people like is they like the individual anecdotal stories that people tell us.
Exactly.
See, you can draw a conclusion. What we do is we let the witnesses tell their story, rather than tell our own story with just a citation as to where it came from. We let the witnesses tell their story, and we think that the compilation of the witness testimony, their stories, we think that that's what the readers like.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, we are just about out of time. Where can people go on the web? Is there a website that they can go to find out more information about everything?
Yes, you can go to our website. It's www.roswellinvestigator.com. That's all one word, www.roswellinvestigator.com. You can you'll see my mug there and Don Schmidt's mug, and and we feature the book The Children of Roswell, a seven-decade legacy of fear, intimidation, and cover-up. It'll be prominently featured. And I think if you click on that, it'll take you to Amazon.com or to BarnesandNoble.com.
And there's a whole lot of good stuff.
Yeah, you can also get it at you can also get it at Barnes and Noble bookstores if they still have them, and you can get it there. You can also get on Amazon. You can get it in regular paper, paper type book, what a book used to look like. You can also get it on Kindle, and ebook, and also audio. It's now out in audio.
Oh, wow.
So you can get it any way you want. So have at it.
Thank you so much for joining me tonight, Tom. It's always fascinating, your books, and I love having you on. And hopefully, I'm sure there's another book in the works at some point, so we'll have you back then, too.
All right. It's been my pleasure, Marla.
All right. Well, keep us posted, and I want to thank everyone for listening in tonight as well. And until next time, everybody, blessed be, and merry meet again.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at this same time for another great guest and more cauldron stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2014. Moonlight Hall by Kevin MacLeod, licensed through Incompetech.com.